Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Health Report and Explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Today, we have two reports about energy, its supply and development. In Hong Kong, researchers are seeking government help to develop biofuel from algae. The idea is to make fuel from these simple organisms in a cost-effective way. But first, we hear how the crisis in the Ukraine could have an effect on Russian exports of natural gas to Europe. Gas supplies and biofuel from algae are our subjects today on As It Is. Natural gas prices have risen in Europe because of the crisis in Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Christopher Cruz has more in this report from VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London.
Russia provides about 25% of Europe's natural gas. Ukraine stands between Russia, the supplier, and Europe, the customer. Any conflict between Russia and neighboring countries can affect gas prices and supplies to the West. Simon Pirani is a researcher at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies in Britain.
The prices have risen in the traded market over the past couple of days because of anxiety about the availability of gas over both the medium and the long term.
Europe needs Russia for much of its gas supply. Ukraine is highly dependent on Russian gas. Russian companies can increase prices suddenly. That is what the huge energy company Gazprom says it will do next month for gas it sells to Ukraine. The Ukrainian state-owned company Naftogaz already owes Gazprom about $2 billion. The European Union is willing to help. The European Commissioner for Energy, Günther Oettinger, said last week that the EU would pay Ukraine's gas debt. He also said there were no immediate concerns about gas supplies in Europe.
Es besteht im Augenblick kein Grund zur Beunruhigung.
He said the EU's member states are in a good position at the moment. European gas supplies in storage are higher than last year. European officials remember that in 2006 and 2009, Russia cut off gas supplies to Ukraine over price disputes. Europe also experienced shortages. Cold winters and low supplies meant that prices rose sharply. Partly because of these problems, European buyers are now less dependent on gas sent through Ukraine. The Nord Stream pipeline opened in 2011. It carries gas under the Baltic Sea to Germany. Europe's biggest economy is also Russia's biggest gas customer. Simon Pirani says European countries took steps to build more pipelines after the first Russia-Ukraine dispute.
There's also been quite a lot of work done in Central and Eastern Europe as a result of the 2009 dispute, when people realized that Russia-Ukraine disputes could have implications further down the pipeline.
That includes the South Stream project. Russian President Vladimir Putin attended a ceremony as the first parts of the pipeline were connected in 2012. The pipeline will stretch along the bottom of the Black Sea directly to southeastern Europe. It is expected to start operating in 2015. It could provide much of Europe's gas needs. However, tensions are increasing over Russia's apparent troop deployment in Crimea. The Russian government has denied any deployment. The EU has threatened possible action against Russia. There is a concern that the country could suspend gas shipments to Europe. Simon Perani does not believe that is likely.
Gazprom is a commercial company. It has to make money. It wants to deliver its gas to its customers in Europe.
Observers say the current tensions will likely make Europe increase efforts to find other energy supplies and cut its dependence on Russia. I'm Christopher Cruz.
A team of scientists in Hong Kong is testing microalgae to clean wastewater and produce fuel. Rebecca Valley in Hong Kong has been following the story. Karen Leggett has her report.
Hong Kong researchers are asking the government to support development of biofuel from algae. The idea is to protect the young industry from foreign competition. Ho Kin Chung is an environmental scientist from the Open University of Hong Kong. He has been studying ways to create energy from algae. He says the process is simple. It uses some of the main or intrinsic qualities of the plant.
Some of the algae, they contain a very high content of oil.
Scientists have been experimenting with biofuels for many years. Biofuels capture the energy stored in plants to make fuel. Researchers develop them as a way to reduce dependence on fossil fuels such as petroleum and coal. Still, there is a debate over how some kinds of biofuels affect water and land use. Researchers became interested in algae because it is easy to grow and care for. It also can be grown in seawater without using agricultural or drinking water. Ho Kin Chung says the necessary technology is solid, but still very costly. In fuel markets, he says, algae biofuel has to compete with traditional fuels. Petroleum or natural gas costs 30% to 40% less. He says linking biofuel production with wastewater treatment can make the process more cost-effective. Algae depend on nitrogen and phosphorus to grow. These are exactly the chemicals that need to be removed from wastewater. Ho Kin Chung says he will ask the government for a $1.3 million grant to develop a pilot program at a wastewater treatment center in Hong Kong. Steve Choi is the executive director of Dynamic Progress International. The company is one of the first businesses in Hong Kong to sell biofuels to the public. He says the government should agree to test locally made biofuels in its day-to-day operations. I'm Karen Leggett.
Thank you.
And that is As It Is for today. I'm Mario Ritter. Thank you for joining us. Keep listening for the latest world news at the top of the hour Universal Time. And join us again tomorrow for another As It Is.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health Report. A new study finds that more than 13 million deaths could be prevented in China over the next 40 years if the country had stronger anti-smoking measures. But the study's authors say China has not taken many steps to control the use of tobacco. The study was published in the British Medical Journal. China signed the World Health Organization's International Treaty on Tobacco Control in 2003, but it has not put in place many of the WHO's ideas to help people stop smoking. Experts say following these ideas could cut smoking by 40% before the year 2050. Without stronger anti-smoking measures, there could be 50 million tobacco-related deaths in the country over that time. The authors of the study used a computer program called SimSmoke to make their predictions. David Levy works at Georgetown University's Lombardi Cancer Center in Washington, D.C. He says China has one-third of the world's cigarette smokers. More than half of the men in China smoke. Mr. Levy says people often begin smoking without knowing it will harm their health. He says people in some countries smoke because it makes them feel important.
Smoking, once it gets established, and in many of the low and middle income countries, you know, there's a kind of a prestige initially to smoking.
The WHO plan calls for a ban on smoking in all public places. It also calls for countries to place health warnings on cigarette containers and offer programs to help people stop smoking. And it says there should be high taxes on tobacco. Experts say a 75% increase in cigarette taxes could save about 3.5 million lives. They say an end to cigarette advertising could save 2 million lives. After signing the WHO agreement, China placed a 12% tax on cigarettes. But the government did not force Chinese smokers to pay the tax. One of the authors of the new study is Tai Wei Hu. He is a professor of public policy economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Hu says China's culture and society are changing. He said President Hu Jintao supports a ban on smoking in public. The president also wants people to stop giving cigarettes as gifts to officials and employers. Mr. Hu says the most effective anti-smoking measure in China would be a large increase in the cigarette tax, but he does not expect that to happen soon. And that's the Health Report from VOA Learning English. For more stories about health, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Milagros Ardine.
Music. I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Barbara Klein with Explorations in VOA Special English. Today, we tell about a program in the 1960s to train women as astronauts. Today, they are known as the Mercury 13. They never reached their goal of spaceflight, but they led the way for other American women to travel into space.
In 1959, the United States was involved in a space race with the former Soviet Union. The Soviets had surprised the world by launching the first satellite. Sputnik 1 was launched into orbit on October 4, 1957. Suddenly, the United States appeared to be behind in an important area of technology. As a result, President Dwight Eisenhower formed the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in 1958. By April 7, 1959, NASA introduced the first American astronauts. They were Scott Carpenter, Gordon Cooper, John Glenn, Virgil Grissom, Walter Schirra, Alan Shepard, and Donald Slayton. They were known as the Mercury 7.
In the fall of that year, William Randolph Lovelace was attending a meeting of the Air Force Association in Miami, Florida. Dr. Lovelace was deeply involved in the effort to put Americans into space. He served on NASA's Special Committee on Life Sciences. Astronaut candidates had been put through tests at his medical center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dr. Lovelace and Air Force Brigadier General Donald Flickinger wondered if women could be trained as astronauts. General Flickinger had designed the space flight tests for the astronaut candidates. He also knew that the Russians had plans to launch a woman into space. The two men met with Jerry Cobb, a 28-year-old pilot. They thought Ms. Cobb would make a good female astronaut candidate. They invited her to Dr. Lovelace's Medical Research Center in Albuquerque for tests.
Jerry Cobb went to Dr. Lovelace's medical center in February of 1960. She spent 1 week receiving the same series of tests that the Mercury 7 astronauts faced. These tests included a general physical examination and X-rays. Some tests involved electric shock. Other tests pushed the body to its physical limits. Yet another test required freezing the inner ear with ice water to test for the condition of vertigo. The doctors also measured brain waves. They performed a total of 75 tests on Jerry Cobb.
Jerry Cobb had one unusual test on a machine called the Multi-Axis Space Test Inertia Facility, or MASTIF. The MASTIF was in NASA's Lewis Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio. This special machine could move a person in three different directions almost at the same time. It was designed to test a pilot's ability to control a spacecraft under severe conditions. Jerry Cobb passed the test.
During her tests, Jerry Cobb knew that if she failed the first level of astronaut training, no other woman would be tested. By August, the results of the tests were complete. Dr. Lovelace was fully satisfied that Jerry Cobb had scored similarly to the Mercury 7 astronauts. He even noted that Ms. Cobb required less oxygen than the average male astronaut. Jerry Cobb's success meant that more female candidates were needed for more tests.
Jerry Cobb helped Dr. Lovelace and General Flickinger choose female astronaut candidates. She searched among members of the International Women's Aviation Group, the 99s, based in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Ms. Cobb worked hard to develop a list of good candidates by August 1961. 25 other women pilots were chosen and tested at Dr. Lovelace's research center. Candidates had to have flown an airplane for more than 1,000 hours. Generally, they were required to be in their early 30s, and they had to be in good physical health.
Not all the women invited to Albuquerque passed Dr. Lovelace's tests. After the first level of testing, only 13 remained, including Jerry Cobb. The youngest among them was 21-year-old Wally Funk, who was also a competitive skier. 40-year-old Jane Hart was the oldest. She was married to Senator Philip Hart of Michigan. She also flew helicopters. Other members of the group were Myrtle Cagle, twin sisters Jan and Marion Dietrich, Jean Hickson, and Jean Nora Stumbaugh Jessen. Also included were Irene Leverton, Bernice Stedman, Sarah Gerlich Ratley, Jerry Sloan Truhill, and Rhea Hurley Waltman. These women would be known as the Mercury 13. They had passed the first level of tests that the Mercury 7 astronauts faced. They now wanted to progress to the next level.
Not all the Mercury 13 women took the next level of testing. For the Mercury 7 male astronauts, psychological and spaceflight testing took place at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. However, NASA would not permit testing to be done on the women at that base. Only Jerry Cobb, Wally Funk, and Rhea Waltman would receive special psychiatric testing for space fitness in Oklahoma City. At the same time, Dr. Lovelace began plans for flight training the candidates. The United States Naval School of Aviation Medicine agreed to test Jerry Cobb for 10 days in Pensacola, Florida. Jerry Cobb passed a series of tests meant for Navy pilots and astronauts. She would be the only one of the Mercury 13 to successfully complete all the tests that Mercury 7 astronauts took. She would also be the only one who had the chance to do so.
Dr. Lovelace had made plans to test the other women in the group at Pensacola. After a delay, September 18th was chosen as the day for flight testing to begin. But it never took place. The women received telegram messages saying the tests had been canceled 4 days before they were to begin. The Navy wanted NASA to approve the training. NASA resisted the idea. Jerry Cobb and Jane Hart immediately tried to get the testing restarted. Their efforts led to a committee hearing in Congress, but the women found little support. Astronaut John Glenn spoke to the committee. He said, "The fact that women are not in this field is a fact of our social order." Glenn later said that he would not oppose a female astronaut program, but he saw no requirement for one.
After 2 days of hearings, members of Congress had heard enough. They would do nothing to change NASA's decision not to train women for spaceflight. But the answer about women in space came less than 1 year after those congressional hearings. On June 16, 1963, Russian cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space. She orbited the Earth 48 times and spent almost 3 days in space.
The Mercury 13 women were never officially part of the NASA space program, but their willingness to undergo testing to be astronauts and their performance in those tests showed that women could go into space. It was not until 1983 that Sally Ride became the first American woman in space. 16 years later, Eileen Collins became the first woman to command a space shuttle mission. She invited the surviving members of the Mercury 13 to attend the launch. 7 women were able to attend. On May 12, 2007, the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh also honored these women. The university gave honorary Doctor of Science degrees to the 8 surviving members of the Mercury 13. The university said it was honoring the spirit and efforts of this special group of women.
This program was written and produced by Mario Ritter. I'm Barbara Klein.
And I'm Steve Ember. You can read and listen to this program on our website, voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for Explorations in VOA Special English.